So I don't know about you, but I grew up thinking of the story of Exodus, you know, the book in the Bible that recalls God hearing the cries of the people, releasing them from slavery, leading them through the wilderness to the promised land. And I always thought that story began and ended with Moses. And you remember that first story of Moses, don't you, from Sunday school or from the animated movie Prince of Egypt? I don't think Ten Commandments actually starts that early. I think they pick up Moses's life later in the story, if I recall properly. But baby Moses is in danger because there has been an order that all boy babies are to be killed, of Hebrew babies are to be killed. And so his mother hides him for as long as she can, and then in desperation, she weaves a basket out of reeds, remember this, puts the baby in the basket, sets it afloat in the Nile, where Pharaoh's daughter comes down to bathe, sees the baby, has pity on him, brings him into her household, and raises him as a prince of Egypt. It's a story that captured my imagination as a child, and I can still see the flannel board figures, that's how old I am, and the pages that I colored in Sunday school. I even vaguely think I remember weaving a basket out of construction paper and sticking a clothespin baby Moses into the basket at one point. But it turns out that that story is in Exodus chapter 2. At chapter 1, we get a backstory that's important if we are to make sense of what comes after. And so that is what we're going to read today, and I'm going to actually start at the beginning of the chapter and pick up those first 7 verses as well. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each of his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And the total number of people born to Jacob was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase and, in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over the Hebrews to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more the people multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, God gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews, you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. This is a story that is loaded with ironic twists. Joseph, who had been the great savior of Egypt, has been forgotten. Midwives, whose job it is to bring babies into the world, are enlisted to usher them into the next. The plan is to kill off the slaves through forced labor, and the labor they're assigned to is building supply cities that are designed to protect and sustain the life of the Egyptian people. But the first thing that jumped out at me is the fact that the powerful Egyptians who hold all of the cards are afraid of the powerless Israelites. The oppressors are afraid of the oppressed, which, while it seems counterintuitive, is so often the way it works, isn't it? It seems to be built into our human experience. You look around the world. The Israelites today are afraid of the disenfranchised Palestinians. The Myanmar government fears the Rohingya refugee, and USSR is afraid of little Ukraine. Even though they hold all of the power, they react out of fear. They tighten the screws and raise the stakes. The Egyptians moved from ruthless injustice, using the people as forced labor, to attempted genocide, all based on what-if fear. What if we find ourselves in a war, they reason, and our prolific Hebrew population shifts their allegiance and defects to our enemy? It was a fear shared by slave owners in our own nation as the slave population grew and spread to the point that by the outbreak of the Civil War in 1860, two of our states, South Carolina and Mississippi, actually had a slave population that outnumbered the free. And of course, the reason we exist as a nation is because we were once on the receiving end of this what-if thinking. As we celebrate the birth of our nation this week, we can't help but remember that we exist as a country in large part because, like the Hebrews, we prospered in this new land, and that worried Mother England. So they tried to profit from us while also keeping us under their control through burdensome taxation and other economic and political controls, which is essentially Egypt's plan A, their first line of defense. They try to literally work the Hebrews to death, but it doesn't work. In spite of the harsh conditions and the abuse, their population continues to grow. And what had been a theoretical concern blossomed into a full-blown paranoia, leaving Pharaoh to come up with an unthinkable plan B of genocide. Pharaoh calls the two Hebrew midwives to him and directs them to kill every infant boy born to the slaves, though they were graciously permitted to allow the girl babies to live. What a position to find themselves in, ordered to smother to death the very lives they were trained and commissioned to shepherd into this world. I have to admit that I read this story and I picture it as an episode of Call the Midwife. I love that show. I don't know if anybody else is as addicted to this show. I see a few heads shaking, and yeah, there's a few that in here that are with me. I just wish the Brits would make their seasons longer than 8 episodes. I just feel like they just give me a little taste of the show and then it goes away for a year. And but as I read this story, I wonder what would Trixie or Phyllis or Sister Julianne do in this situation? You know, and as the show has developed, I've seen them deal with big challenges like discrimination and poverty, domestic violence and changing sexual mores. But what would they do if they were faced with an order to commit infanticide, for that matter, what would I do? On the one hand, it seems as if it would be an obvious choice. I would refuse, right? I'd do the right thing. You put the child's life above your own. But it really isn't that easy or straightforward, is it? We human beings have an uncanny ability to rationalize evil. I've always wondered who I would have been had I lived in Europe in World War II. Would I have risked myself for the sake of my Jewish, gypsy, or gay neighbors? Would I have helped them to escape? Would I have stood up for them when they were persecuted? Would I have hidden them in my home? If I'm honest, I don't even know if I would have joined the pastor of this congregation back when our neighbors were being sent to Japanese internment camps, when he went as they were lined up to give them coffee and donuts. I'm pretty sure that I would have thought that what was going on was wrong, that it grieved God, but would I have acted? Would I have taken that risk? These two women did. They made the uncompromisingly courageous choice and refused to kill any of the babies. As Roberta Hestinus once observed, the armies of Egypt were powerful at this period of history. The culture of Egypt was the dominant culture, and the order comes down, kill the boys. The girls could be kept as house servants and slaves, but kill the boys. And do it in such a way that it doesn't look like we did it. Then two ordinary women, who probably were illiterate, said no. That took courage. Where did it come from? The Bible explains it by saying, because they feared God. They had a fundamental conviction that while there was a Pharaoh, there was a God over Pharaoh. And while they must give account to human authorities and powers, they must give account to one over all human authorities and powers. They feared God, and they said no. And even when they were called back to Pharaoh to answer for their failure to obey his order, they still held firm. They came up with the audacious, yet not completely improbable argument that they intended to obey Pharaoh, but the Hebrew women, they were just too hardy. The babies were already born by the time they arrived, so they didn't have the opportunity to smother the child before he could draw his first breath. After all, they argued and reasoned, the Egyptian women, because of the slave culture, were pampered, while the Hebrew women had been made strong through hard work. So it might be true that labor generally went more easily for the Israelite women than for their masters' wives. They did it all because they feared God. On Wednesday, I went to see the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, about Fred Rogers. In Bible study that day, Alan and Glory were talking about the movie and what a great film it had been. And so I realized I was going to be home alone that night, and Steve didn't want to go, so I decided I'd go. I texted Tracy. I said, hey, I'm going to the movie at 4:40. You want to join me? And she did, and I'm so glad we went. Because Fred Rogers, who was a Presbyterian pastor, by the way, was also a man who knew what it was to fear God. Not fear as in live afraid of God, doing good only because he was afraid that God would zap him if he didn't, but fear of God as in respect for who God is, as in caring for the things that God cares about, as in recognizing that God is our good creator and worthy of our obedience. Fear of God that is lived out through the two great commandments of love God and love your neighbor. And that commitment to love led him to tackle some sensitive and risky subjects, like the time that he soaked his feet in a wading pool with the African-American character on the show during a time when blacks were being forbidden to swim in public swimming pools, or when he talked to the children through puppets about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Following 9/11 and near the end of his life, he was called out of retirement to make a public service announcement for PBS. He's captured before the filming expressing his concern about what he could possibly say that could be any help in such a time. But then he goes ahead and speaks as honestly and respectfully as he always did about our need to take care of the children in times like that. How we should reassure them that we adults would do all that we can to keep them safe. However, there's one thing that he said that particularly captured my attention. I actually had to go back and make sure I had heard it right and got it right. He used a Hebrew phrase urging his listeners to become tikkun olam. Tikkun olam. Repairers of creation. This is a concept rooted in an understanding that God created the world and human beings as good. Yet somewhere along the way, things went wrong. All you have to do is look around the world to see the truth of it. Governments are self-serving, institutions fail us, we ourselves fall victim to sin and evil. Yet God does not give up on creation or on you and me, who are created in the divine image. And so when we see things that are wrong in the world, when we are tempted to cooperate with evil or take the easy way out to look the other way, God calls us to remember our allegiance and to partner with God in repairing creation, which is what these women did. They had the courage to risk themselves for the sake of God's creation. And where did that courage come from? It came from their conviction that God is worthy of their trust, that God means good for all people and is active in the world to save and redeem. And this conviction was stronger than their fear of Pharaoh. I recall the words in our Book of Order when I think of this courage. It calls for the church and therefore each of us to undertake our God-given mission, even at the risk of our own life. We aren't called to play it safe as followers of God. It isn't a nice world out there. There are powerful forces that would bend us to their will. But there is also a God who comes to us with love and strength and vision and invites us to be tikkun olam, repairers of creation. And the good news is that we don't have to do it alone. I think one of the great gifts that God gave these two women was the gift of each other. I suspect that a good bit of their courage came from the simple fact that they didn't have to face the challenge alone. They went together. It's like when Piglet and Pooh, there's a time that Piglet sidles up to Pooh from behind and whispers, "Pooh." "Yes, Piglet?" "Nothing," says Piglet, taking Pooh's paw. "I just wanted to be sure of you." Shifra was sure of Pooh. Pooh was sure of Shifra. And they were both sure of God. And that made all the difference. And in the end, God honors them. These two ordinary slave women not only survived their trial, but God blessed them with families of their own. And they are remembered. Pharaoh's name, you will notice, is not recorded. His name is lost in the annals of time. But over 3,000 years later, we still remember these two women by name. The names Shifra and Pooh have endured to remind us that loving God and loving neighbor above all else can change the world. and that what we say no to can be as important as what we say yes to. In fact, by the grace of God, it can repair our world. Thanks be to God. Amen.